Welcome to Talking Story. I'm your host, Lynn Hadley, and our guest today is the very talented and amazingly adept Jessamine Grace West. You may have heard her on KMUN on Monday evenings, programming the psychedelic folk show Day of the Velvet Voice, or taken a belly dance class from her at the Astoria Arts and Movement Center, where she is founder, executive director, and instructor. She is certified in everything from holistic horse massage to Moga Dao Qigong instruction, and is currently serving as ward for Astoria City Councilwoman. Welcome, Jessamine.
Wow, I forget that I have done all that stuff. Yes. Which is why it took us 2 months to get this scheduled.
Yes, indeed. Where should we begin?
Anywhere you like. Thanks for having me,
Lynn. Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. And I wonder if you would mind talking about one of my favorite places, Turkey. How long did you live there?
Yeah, so I lived in central Turkey for almost 2 years. I moved to Astoria about, I guess, 14 or 15 years ago. And it was a few years before that I had lived in central Turkey. So I have a science degree in anthropology and had been working for the Department of International Affairs and the Middle East Studies Center at Portland State, and a job offer came up in central Turkey, and I took it, and it was easily, I've lived in West Africa, Mexico City, and central Turkey would be the three main places that I worked in my 20s with that degree, and Turkey was definitely my favorite. I loved all of them, but Turkey's amazing. I lived in a really small town called Ürgüp, in an area that's called Cappadocia. So a lot of people know it because of kind of the landscape has what they call fairy chimneys, which I think people told me was featured in a part of Star Wars as their houses or something like that. It's this very dramatic, almost prehistoric looking topography that's really incredible through there. I loved it. The music, the food, the people, the culture, the archaeology. So yeah.
An amazing experience. Is that what took you to your movement and kind of belly dance connection, or was it the anthropology in general?
Actually, I grew up with a mother who was a belly dancer. And so when I was about five, I remember, that's the earliest I remember really listening to her. She had all these old records, really listening to those records and being drawn to them even at a very young age. And she had this giant hope chest in her bedroom that we had to ask permission to get into. But whenever we could, I went straight to, she had a pair of zils, which are the finger cymbals. It's a Turkish word for finger cymbal. Sagat is the Arabic version of that. They're a little bit different. Sagat has one hole in the top for the finger strap, and then zils have two. I don't know if anybody would care about that, but I loved playing with her zils. So the finger cymbals, they were huge. They, you know, as a five-year-old, they looked like dinner plates, but I think that's the earliest I remember being really drawn to that form of dance and the rhythms and the music.
And you went on to study with Sakra and Aziza. Those are like big names in that world.
I was so blessed to have two really incredible teachers as my first instructors. So I've studied with a lot of other people before and taken a lot of workshops. But I think it really matters, you know, your first experience as a new student. You know, I was 17. This was back in 1994. And just nervous, you know. So, but Sakra and Aziza were both my first teachers back when, I think in 93, it was kind of hard to find, more difficult than it is now to find an instructor. Sakura was in Vancouver, Washington, and Aziza was in Portland. And they were so positive and encouraging and joyous, and they had this incredible history of people that they studied with, and they're kind of the teachers. They're just amazing women, and they're both still teaching and dancing. So,
yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It definitely set me off on a path to seek it out and study other styles and everything, which I did get to do in Turkey as well.
And obviously that movement is in your blood, and fortunately it brought you to Astoria, and you established the Astoria Arts and Movement Center.
Yeah, so I had moved back to my hometown of Portland after living in Turkey, and never really quite caught up with the city again. I think I was burnt out on anthropology, which I had thought that was going to be my career. And so just kind of in a bit of turmoil, I guess, regarding what I was going to do, I went back to work at Portland State and then went back to school to get certified for the work that I do with horses. And that took about 3 years. And in that time, just started looking for a different place to live that wasn't in the city. I think the city had, I had certainly changed living in a small town in central Turkey, but the city was just too fast for me. I'm pretty easily distracted, which is unfortunate. I'm why they put, you know, shiny things at the checkout line, because I'm like, oh, look at this. And so in the city, you know, if I really want to be able to focus, I have to step outside of all that stimulation, so to speak. I didn't know anybody in Astoria. I had met Heidi, who was a programmer here Thursday nights, who was amazing, through a friend. But really, I just started driving out here on the weekends when I wasn't working or at school, and looking for a place to live. I always wanted to live closer to the water, and so this was kind of my chance to do that.
Yeah, well, and fortunate for us, you got involved with KMUN.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing the Day of the Velvet Voice?
Gosh, well, and I just realized I forgot to answer your question about the Astoria Arts and Movement Center. But to answer your question about KMUN, my show is turned 10 years old last June.
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, I took the programmer class, and Elizabeth, who I love, she looks at me and she goes, how long are you going to stick around? Because I think she could sense that I wasn't sure about Astoria just yet, even having lived here for 3 or 4 years. And I said, oh, no, I'm sticking around. Yeah, I wasn't sure still, but so she gave me a show, and my original time slot was every other Monday night, or excuse me, my original time slot was every Monday night from midnight to 1 a.m. And then that later changed, and now I alternate with Slab, who's wonderful, every other Monday night from 10 to midnight. So, yeah, just over 10 years old.
Yeah. It's a fun slot, and psychedelic folk, no less.
It is, yeah. Well, originally I had pitched Middle Eastern music, and Elizabeth was like, no one's going to want to listen to that for an hour. So I thought, you know, and it is a late night. I had a lot of really old Middle Eastern music and pop, and so, you know, I think the fact, too, that I was new, you know, she said, kind of go back to the drawing board and resubmit something. And so I looked at my collection, and I guess psychedelic folk is probably the easiest way to describe kind of what I had a fair amount of. So things like the most well-known people would be like Tim Buckley or Donovan, Nick Drake, you know, Buffy St. Marie is even getting in there a little bit. But and I like to play a lot of that era from other countries. Incredible String Band is another one that people recognize a lot. But
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, 10 years, that's a good run, and still going strong, I hope.
It is, and to finish, because I totally sidestepped your question about the AAMC. I started that in 2011, and it was really just because I moved here, and I love dance, and I knew all, I had met a handful of people that really wanted to teach, but there wasn't a studio or a space, and so Dwight, who is a photographer that lived around the corner from me, we would get together for dinner sometimes every other week. He was on the board of the First Presbyterian Church. And he was like, well, we have an empty fellowship hall that's not being used. And so that's really where it got started, was in the fellowship hall of the church. And they were very gracious with really inexpensive rent. And we ended up moving into where we are now just because we started to grow. And so there was too much overlap with their schedule. So now we're in the Odd Fellows building. The Astoria School of Ballet was in there, the second floor historic ballroom, and then they relocated to the Liberty. So when that opened up and I saw it, I thought, oh my God, you know.
There it is.
There it is, yeah. And we've been there ever since, so.
It's a lovely location.
Yeah.
And there for a while, there was a little bit of question as to whether you would be able to maintain that, but that's been resolved.
I like the twinkle in your eye when you ask me that. Yeah, what a really challenging journey that was. When I say we, I mean the AAMC, which is now a pretty big collective of instructors who teach there. And the building went up for sale. It was previously owned by Luotamus Partners, and they owned a lot of properties in town and slowly began to sell them off. And so when the Odd Fellows building went up for sale, I think like any tenant or renter, you cross your fingers that somebody's going to buy it and let you stay. And, you know, you expect your rent to go up possibly, but you hope it's not too bad. But yeah, it was just every potential buyer that wanted to buy that building. Pretty much all of them, their plan was just to kind of displace all of the tenants and remodel the building. You know, this incredible historic building that's like going back in time almost a century. And, you know, open a bar or a brewery or an event center, a lot of things that we kind of already have. And so that was really difficult. That was the hardest year of my life, almost losing. The AAMC is such a huge part of my life. And so when you think about losing that, you think about all of the students or even the instructors whose lives have been impacted by taking a dance class, for instance. And, you know, to some folks that might not sound like much, but if you are, I mean, for instance, when I was talking about belly dance earlier, if you have kind of this internal calling to try something, sometimes it takes a lot of strength to follow that. And so with the AAMC, like, we need to be available for when somebody wants to abide by that calling. So fast forward to now, I'm trying to think. Yeah, our board president, Andrea Mazzarella, she said, well, why don't we buy it? And we were both renters and had never owned anything, let alone a building. But we put in an offer, and then in 6 months, you know, we raised enough money for the down payment, and we bought the building March 28th of 2018, so it's been just over a year. And it's been, and her mother, Nancy, is the third member of the LLC. So it's the three of us women that closed the sale.
Fabulous.
Yeah, it's been really incredible.
You are tuned to Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria 91.9. and KTCB Tillamook 89.5. You're listening to Talking Story. I'm your host, Lynn Hadley, and our guest today is Jessamine Grace. And thanks for listening. We're going to go back to our interview, but maybe we'll go take a different horse.
Sure. Yeah.
As we come back
to our
interview.
Another part of my life that a lot of people don't know about.
How did you come to identify your passion for horses as a holistic horse massage therapist?
Well, I grew up with horses. I grew up in 4-H and doing FFA, and I had horses growing up. And so I think after finishing high school, you know, I went to college. I kind of just did that whole thing and, again, thought that I would be doing anthropology for the rest of my life. But like I said, I just very grateful for those years and those experiences, especially working in other countries. But I kind of felt like I needed to go back to the drawing board and learn something that I was passionate about. Because the anthropology had become a little bit exhausting living overseas and away from my family. And so I looked at different programs, equine nutrition. You know, there's a lot of already incredible trainers out there. I even looked at, you know, saddle fitting workshops and things like that. And I think the massage appealed to me because it was a newer field, and I'm really fascinated by equine anatomy and physiology. So I used to help teach dissection workshops in Bend, which I know makes some people cringe, but I love horses' bodies, and so to be able to name like every muscle, joint, ligament, be able to work with that, as well as considering, you know, their discipline, the rider, all those other factors, that their conformation that kind of determine the way that they move. And so that's my work with horses. And I've been doing it for about 16 years, I guess, since I got back from Turkey. And I'm getting older and a little physically, it's harder, I've noticed, for me. And so,
well, that's you're dealing with quite a big species.
They're great though. I think probably way easier than people. I don't know. I could be wrong, but a lot of it's, working with gait analysis or, like I said, saddle fitting, things like shadowing or working with any other professionals in the industry that I can. So farriers, a lot of issues with horses originate in their hooves. And so that it's a big canvas to work with, but incredibly remarkable. But I'm doing that work less and less because of the physical demand and focusing more on the Astoria Arts and Movement Center, especially since it's been growing, and with the acquisition of the building, that's kind of where my path is going.
Certainly.
Yeah. But I love horses.
Oh, well. Yeah. And That must be such an interesting and intense experience to connect with an animal through that, like, physicality like that.
It is really intense is a good word for it. And I'm always incredibly appreciative to have that opportunity. I mean, a lot of the horses that I'm working with have been injured or are in some sort of state of recovery. You know, maybe Dr. Ramsey, who's one of our local vets, or Dr. Hunter has worked on them. And I might be one person of a team that's helping the horse kind of get back to a normal gait or something like that on its road to recovery. And so when you have an animal that's wounded, they're very protective of their space. And so I've definitely been injured on the job. I have to be paying attention, like, more than anything else that I do. Because the second that you're distracted or you start thinking about what do I need to get at the store on my way home, you know, you kind of open yourself up to, I mean, just getting bit or stepped on, or, I mean, not that horses are malicious, but again, they don't always, it's not always an overly pleasant experience, the work that I do, because they are sometimes in pain. Mm-hmm. So it is almost like this constant exchange of reading them, you know, which they, a lot of times people say, well, how does a horse, you know, let you know what's wrong with it? It can't say, oh, I have pain in my lower back. But they're actually really direct in their communication, so to speak. So there's all these signs that they give you if you're touching that, say, that particular area, the lumbosacral joint or something like that. And you can, if they'll wince, their ears will pin back, you know, their nostrils will tighten, their breathing will increase, they'll move away from you, all these things that they'll do to let you know where they're having trouble. And so it's kind of a fascinating puzzle to put together, especially if it's a horse I've never worked on before. But yeah, intense.
So, well, what you just described sounds like you're a bit of a horse whisperer.
Well, I mean, people, it's funny because people will say that, like, oh, you're a horse whisperer. And it's, I mean, it's not really a special kind of gift in any way. It's, again, it's an appreciation for their natural movement, the way that their bodies are constructed, and how they communicate, and constantly listening for feedback as far as, because that is how they tell you where the issue or issues might be, and it's usually multiple issues, might be originating from. They're way more direct than people, just to say, you know. But yeah.
So responding to movement, and it seems like from movement to massage and Qigong, and even we haven't even touched on tarot.
Oh, right.
Reading.
I forgot it. Yeah.
You're so grounded in, like, a holistic kind of a spirituality, you know, if I may say so.
Of course.
How have you enriched what you do this way? Or has that come to you? Is it just part of what you do? Is it something you're always learning about by being, like you said, open to what's there?
Spirituality, you mean? Well, I was raised in a very, I know the word spirituality and religion a lot of times overlap. And for me personally, I was raised in a very non-religious household. However, my parents, I think, encouraged a lot of listening and feeling and paying attention and a lot of patience. I don't really know. We spent a lot of time, I mean, as a family, every single Sunday, we had to go for a hike. You know, and when you're a teenager, you don't really want to go hiking with your parents when you're recovering from whatever you did the night before. But I was always so happy when when I got out to Eagle Creek or wherever we were hiking at that day, rain or shine. And I think both of my parents, who were amazing and they're still married and very much still live by this, really encouraged sensitivity to the world, which in their mind is a gift. So yeah, I think that's probably the place that I come from a lot.
And what a wonderful gift they gave you with that.
Thank you.
Well, and now we're on to a totally different horse again.
That's fine.
But this is not equestrian related at all. Before we wrap things up here, how do you like the role as a city councilwoman?
Oh, that's a very different horse. That's a great horse. That's a super fast horse. I love it. I really do. It's been a really, I oftentimes am shocked even now that I was appointed because of course, Bruce, who was the previous councilor for Ward 4, was elected mayor, which opened up his seat. And, you know, I was up against some really incredible people in the community and definitely saw myself as a bit of an underdog, like of the applicants. And I just wanted to try my best. And so when I was appointed, definitely some shock there, but I really hit the ground running or tried to and have been doing that ever since, where I've just been learning as much as I possibly can. And, you know, I love the rest of the council, like Joan Herman, Roger Rocca, Tom Brownson, Mayor Bruce Jones. They have been so wonderful to work with. We don't always agree, of course. But everybody's really respectful, and certain people have really spent a lot of time with me, helping me, people like Cindy Price on the Planning Commission, and Mayor Bruce Jones, too. I've had a million questions along the way. So I like it. I really like it. Yeah, I want to try to do the best job possible in this window that I've been given.
And are there specific things that you're setting your sights on as far as focus for your time there? Is it just as needed, you're ready to respond?
I think it's definitely the latter. It was interesting because I was asked several times what my platform was when I applied, and I honestly didn't have a particular agenda. Obviously, some of the biggest issues on City Council's plate right now are homelessness, Riverwalk or riverfront development, traffic comes up a lot, especially, you know, it's August. And so really trying to respond to those specific things while I'm staying on top of the other stuff that comes our way too. So yeah, definitely the latter. Just whatever is important to the people at the time, I'm listening.
All right. Well, as usual, things are flying by time-wise. It's been a delight speaking with you today.
Thanks,
is there anything we didn't touch on that you'd like to add?
I'm just so happy to be here, and it's great. It's great to be asked these kind of questions. So I really appreciate you having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Thanks for tuning in, Talking Story.